On this episode of Mechs and Men, a couple of shrewd boys swap a Pontiac to slay a griffin. Kim puts Justin to bed so she can go out for coffee. And Arden takes out a couple of princesses before meeting with Melissa to help her make a name for herself. Hello, this is Of Mechs and Men, a Battletech book club. I am Kanan Hill, joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent.
Hi, I'm Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
How we doing, boys?
Well, I'm boiling some water because I like my spaghetti al dente.
Well, that's good, because this week we're chewing through chapters 22 through 27 of the book we've been working through.
Warrior on Guard. By Michael A. Stackpole.
Let's get into it.
Chapter 22. Solara 7. 20th of March, 3027. We open with Justin in the mech bay with his crew, and they're working on a mech. Fateng is here too. He's now on Justin's team. Now it's Justin, Fateng, and that tech from before. And also, Gray Notin and Kim show up. Justin and Kim, they have the moment because Justin's about to go out for a fight, and she gives him the whole come home in one piece, lover, and all that. And we see Gray Notin is looking up at the mech that they're working on. And Justin turns and he asks him, so what do you think, Gray? And Gray says, a centurion is not held in very high esteem here on Solaris. And also I was like, oh, is that true? I thought a centurion is pretty cool. I don't know.
They're great line mechs, but he makes a point about the LRMs not very good in factory. And I imagine in a lot of the arenas, they're going to be of minimal usefulness. Also, the Centurion is known for having an autocannon that has a bit of a jamming problem.
Well, Gray doesn't think the Centurion is very good, and he asks Justin if he got it cheap, and Justin tells him, actually, it's a loan, and we learn that he got the money from Kim Sorensen, because she's a rich girl, remember? She does express that she does expect repayment. She says, you know, I just don't give money to the men I live with.
It's some real, like, I don't buy every pool boy a mech kind of energy.
Exactly.
Justin's just like, I love you.
Yeah.
And after that part, I did have to go back to the first Solaris fight chapter. And I was like, how long ago was that? And it was just a month. And I was like, man, Justin moves quick here.
It's a month. Yeah.
Is it Justin or is it the Contessa?
Just in time.
Just in time.
They talk about how his next fight is in the factory and about, like you said, LRMs are no good in the factory. We learn about the factory arena. That's the Merrick Arena. It's in Montenegro. That's the Free Worlds League section of Solar City. It's this old mech factory, right? So it's mech scale, and they've rigged it up with all these cameras, all these holo cameras and such, so that the mechs, they can get real sneaky peeky. There's a lot of hide and seek. They're in this big factory. It's cool.
But it gets the impression that, like, you're going in and out of these kind of cramped mech spaces, though, right? Where it's like, oh, like, there's lots of places for ambushes. And it's not like kind of the open style of Steiner Stadium, as we've previously seen. There's even, like, apparently different floors to the factory, which is pretty interesting. It's designed around it kind of being like, oh, these are going to all be like knife fights, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love how it describes it. It's like it's going to be a lot of close combat fighting. And I bet those are some pretty exciting matches to watch out of the Solaris games there.
This sounds pretty cool. Notin tells Justin that he has heard that the fight has been fixed. And Justin admits that certain people have made it known that he is to lose to Peter Armstrong this evening. Certain interests have contacted him and made suggestions, if you will.
Oh, yeah, the people that make your legs not work so good.
Exactly. Justin will be fighting Billy Armstrong, and Gray Notin agrees that currently Armstrong is Capet's best fighter in the medium class. But he says that Wolfson's an up-and-comer. But for now, he's fighting Armstrong. Notin asks Justin if he refused the fix. And Justin's like, yeah, I refuse the fix. Actually, he says, I will never kowtow to anyone who swears allegiance to Hans Davian or the Federated Sons. And Gray asks him, oh, so you will never accept a fix? And Justin tells him, he's just like, never bet against me, Gray. I will always win.
It's Justin time.
Justin, like, immediately goes off the deep end, and Gray's just like, all right, man, I gotcha.
Yeah, he's been completely jokerfied by this point.
Yeah, Justin's mental health does seem like it's taken a dive.
Yeah, and he's got a Centurion. That's cool.
That is cool. There's one thing I want to point out. Notin notices something about Justin's Centurion. It appears that he's had the tech take armor off the right arm and put it on the left. We'll come back to that, though.
Okay. Also, don't forget that Gray Notin tells Justin that after he wins tonight, he'll take him to Valhalla. So that's cool. Valhalla! Let's go. Justin's going to go to Valhalla, dude. If he wins.
It's got some real, like, if you do good tonight, I'm going to, like, take you to Pizza Hut energy.
Yeah. We're going to go to the club. So we cut over to Justin. He is in the arena, and he's awaiting the beginning of the match. And the announcer, he's doing his introductions. They introduce Justin and his mech, this Centurion. It's named Yen Lo Wang. Named after the Chinese god of the dead, king of the nine hells, Yen Lo Wang. This is Justin's iconic hero mech. It's Yen Lo Wang. Here it is.
It's Yen Lo Wang. It'll be surprising if you've gotten this far in the books and not had someone bring up Yen Lo Wang. It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, that it's is one cool that you job. Come across. Yeah.
It's in the box set. At Target.
It's in the box set. Yep. At Target. Yeah. That's right. BattleTech Essentials.
And we now have seen both mechs that are part of it. We now have Legend Killer and Yen Lo Wang.
Oh, that's true.
And if you check out anything in the BattleTech community, you're seeing a lot of Yen Lo Wang paint jobs right now. So
it's exciting. It's cool seeing all of the like different takes on it.
Oh, also we learn from the announcer that Justin has had three fights already since coming to Solaris, but this is his first one in the Centurion. The others were all in Vindicators. And Justin's opponent tonight is Peter Armstrong, right? And Peter is piloting a Griffin named the Ares. So that's confusing.
One weighs a little bit more than the other.
Yeah.
I wonder how many mech pilots name their mech Ares. I bet it's a common name.
Yeah, they're like, oh, it's like the God of War. Like, you know, I read it in this book.
But the Griffin, this is kind of a scary matchup. It would be a scary matchup if we weren't dealing with what we've already talked about is probably going to be a knife fight in Factory, where the Griffin's weapon systems are going to be at a bit of a disadvantage.
I did find that interesting that Gray Notin does go on about the Centurion. He's like, you're going to be in the factory, and a lot of your LRMs aren't going to be useful there. But during that, he didn't mention the fact that your opponent's in a Griffin. And everything he just said applies to the Griffin here. It's the PPC and LRMs.
More so, even.
That's true.
Yeah. It would have been a neat little follow-up to it if Gray was like, but luckily, you're going to be able to use your strengths against his weaknesses right now. And went into a little guidance, as it seems like Gray has kind of gotten into a mentor role for Justin.
Let's not get too carried away, though, because if this Griffin can catch Yen Lo Wang in a corridor, it can really, like, hold it down. There absolutely could be some scary situations here where the Centurion is at a disadvantage. It's just not to the Griffin's advantage to be fighting in Factory with the weapons loadout it has.
It's funny because Justin actually does right here. He pulls up a readout of the Griffin, like in his cockpit. He checks his Pokédex or whatever. It says that. And he pulls it up and it says the thing tells him that the Griffin has LRMs and a PPC and is widely regarded as a competent distance fighter. I don't think it actually talks like the Pokédex, but I like to think that it does.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a similar thought when I was rereading it this afternoon.
Oh, this is where we also learn about how the Solaris fights take place on like a 10-minute lag time. And this lets the producers like cut footage and add in advertisements. There's a few things here that are just about, he wanted to get in some stuff about the broadcasting situation.
It's cool. They have like these lights set up in the cockpit. If things start getting too stale, because right, there's kind of these compartmentalized almost rooms. And if someone set up an ambush and then the other guys set up an ambush and nothing's happening, like kind of like the director, if you will, flashes the green 3 times. And that means you guys got to move your ass or you're not going to get paid.
I did love that detail because it does change things.
Right.
In terms of thinking like, well, if you do try to battle it out to your best advantage, it could cost you the entire payment.
Justin, when he's checking the readout of the Griffin, he's also thinking about how his opponent might evaluate his mech as well. He figures that Armstrong will try to keep him at a distance and wait for his autocannon to jam,
which I
thought was funny. I don't know about you, but like waiting for your opponent's weapons to malfunction seems like a bad strategy. I don't know. It says his strategy probably hinges on my weapon malfunctioning. I'm like, that doesn't seem that reliable of a strategy.
Yeah, it is weird. It isn't a good strategy. We actually learned it's definitely not a good strategy.
No.
But even here, before the reveal, it's like, yeah, this doesn't quite add up. Now, the distance part does make sense, right? The keeping him at distance.
Apparently, this autocannon sucks so much that your opponent can be like, I'll just wait for it to jam, dude. It won't take long.
It is a known problem. You look at the TRO entry for the Centurion and they're like, it's got a bad autocannon, dude.
The Luxor,
that's right.
It's trash.
When I read this, I did wonder if the cockpit Pokedex here was a static readout of the variant or if they were actually reading the mech specifications of each other. Because with the modification to the Yinlo Wang, if that would be something that Armstrong was able to read from his mech, or if he was going to read it that it had an autocannon 10 in it.
Yeah, that's a good point. The readout could very much be a standard variant, except we get to see later on what he shoots, and it is LRMs and a PPC. So I don't think, but I agree. I think it's just a readout of what a Griffin 1N has and not an actual like signal that he's getting from Armstrong's mech.
That's what I thought. It's like a database.
Right. One last thing, though, we get to see he's like, oh, the factory is so ferrous that he has to kind of switch his scanners to infrared. And we kind of get to see him throughout this kind of like flip between them. Again, this one really, like the last Solaris combat, I feel like we stay in the cockpit.
The match begins, and Justin immediately finds a little spot to hunker down in. It says he kind of pushes some junk out of the way, and he's like, I'm going to hang out here. And yeah, this is where we said earlier, Justin thinks about how if both combatants take up an ambush position, then the producers will flash them. And which doesn't happen. Justin doesn't get the signal. So we have to assume that Armstrong is on the move. Oh, we learn a little bit more about the Tharkad Broadcasting Company here. They have this whole system in place where they beam the footage out to these waiting jump ships. Oh, it says they even have production studios on the jump ships so that they can do editing in space. Video editing in space, Jerry. How cool is that? Old Justin's, he's thinking about how the Tharkad broadcasting guy he was talking to told him that they're thinking that they're going to crack the Karita market soon. And Justin's just laughing to himself. Like here, during the match, he's just like, that's not going to happen. That's so funny. There's no way. He's having a little chuckle about it, like while waiting in ambush. He's debating with himself whether he should fight this man honorably. He's having a moment where it's like, should I wait for him to pass and strike him in the back? Should I come out and duel him? Should I fight him honorably? But then he eventually decides that the man belongs to Hans Davion and then thus deserves no honor. And so none will be given.
As he moves his emo haircut from his face.
It's awesome. This is where the Griffin inches into view and Justin's watching it. He describes the Griffin as looking like a jump trooper dressed in bulky space armor. which I thought was pretty funny.
It's pretty spot on, in all honesty.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Griffin enjoyer.
What's the huge Griffin? Is that a variant?
Oh, no.
It's the assault class Griffin.
Oh, I thought Hugh Griffin was the designer.
Oh, yeah. He would be great as Gray Notin. Hugh Griffin. Love him. So the Griffin comes bumbling in, and Justin stands up, and he turns his speakers on. He says into the mic, he's like, "It's over before it begins, Armstrong." And Armstrong, in the Griffin, he holds his arms out to the side. It's like the Griffin. He like has him hold his arms out, and he says, "Take your best shot, yellow dog." And he makes the Griffin kind of shake its head a little bit. Why would he do this? By the way,
both of them are so over the top at this moment. It's
yeah,
like we get Justin in ultra serious mode, and then Armstrong's out here showboating before the match starts.
It's so funny. Like, it's like, haha.
You don't want to give him a free shot.
Yeah, he's like, "I have ambushed you." And the dude's like, "Hit me center mass, bro." And Justin's like, "Okay.
Welcome to Solaris, ladies and gentlemen."
And so that's what he does. Justin lets an autocannon round rip straight into the middle of the Griffin. This is also where we learn that he has swapped the regular autocannon for a Pontiac. It's a Pontiac Autocannon 20.
A Pontiac 100, a classic Pontiac product.
It's a classic.
I said it would come up again. It did. It's the same autocannon that's in the Victor.
Armstrong also learned that he made a mistake here.
Yeah, he gets this thing, rips him apart. The way it describes it, it's like a shotgun. It isn't just like one round. It's like a bunch of shrapnel and stuff. And it shreds the Griffin's front armor. And Justin fires a laser as well. It even appears to melt like a little bit of the engine shielding. In one hit, Justin does so much damage right off the jump. This fight starts and he like obliterates this Griffin. The dude's chest is red.
This pilot, Armstrong, he clearly thought he was just going to take an AC-10 round to the stomach, which still was a bad idea, but a lot less of a bad idea than this.
And is the AC-20 enough to get into the Griffin's internal armor in the center torso in a single shot?
So that 20 shot is going to clear all of the external armor that's on that Griffin, barring that it's in standard configuration, which nothing has given us an indication that it's not. That medium laser is going to push us into internals, right? And so Stackpole's description there of like the containment for the engine kind of like melting, it's pretty spot on. The Griffin's in a real bad spot. That's what you get for being prideful.
Armstrong's straight up not having a good time.
He hits back though. Armstrong blasts Justin with his LRMs, and he also shoots his PPC, but he misses. He hits him with the missiles, but he misses with the PPC, dude. This is not a good showing.
Oof. That heat's going up, too.
Oh, and then immediately after that, Justin fires his autocannon again, and he blows the PPC off. And the PPC falls off and hits the ground. Dude takes one shot with it and misses, and then loses the weapon. What's going on here? This is crazy. Then Justin fires another laser into the torso, and fire explodes from the Griffin. It catches on fire, and Justin's yelling at Armstrong to eject, but Armstrong doesn't say anything. He's like, "Dude, you got to get out of there." Oh, this is where he sees Armstrong. He shoots his missiles, but he fires them all into the ceiling. Right? It says that the missile rack points up and he shoots them all into the ceiling.
It's already over.
Yeah, the faceplate explodes and flames come pouring out. And the LRMs go off. It fires another volley into the ceiling and the Griffin just drops straight down. Hits the ground. It's over. This guy's dead. Just like that.
It is some real like 30-second title fight energy.
Yeah.
It's like, you did not get your pay-per-view money worth out of this fight.
If you think about it, it just looks bad for Justin all around. He's going to get it from the broadcasting companies. We know he's going to get it because he was supposed to rig the fight. And it wasn't even a show. he just blows into this dude and the mech blows up.
It really won't look good for the Capellan Mafia. This was Capet's number one dude right now.
Exactly, Aaron. This reflects very poorly on the Capellan Mafia.
His dude showed up, clowned, and got put down.
Got clapped. Yeah. Immediately, dude. This is like, it was crazy. I was like, oh, is this going to be a fight? It's like not a fight. It's just like Justin shows up and like obliterates this guy.
Justin brought an AC-20 to a knife fight.
It's sad. Now that Griffin's just slumped against the wall, I like this. Justin thinks to himself that if it wasn't for all the fire and all that, that the mech might resemble a man sleeping peacefully against a wall. And the chapter ends. It just says, he balled his centurion's left hand into a fist. Perhaps someday I too will know such peace.
Dramatic, Justin.
He's so cool.
I do love that Stackpole built up this fight so much. We get the whole broadcasting segment. We got the whole history and rundown of the mech factory. And it's just turn one. This game's over.
Justin is exhibiting what I like to call Papa Roach syndrome. It's some real, you cut yourself open, you sew yourself shut kind of behavior. Psychoanalysts in Solaris have been talking about it for years.
It's something.
I read that mech warriors on Solaris are known to say that the scars remind me that the past is real.
I didn't have Papa Roach on my bingo card tonight.
This is truly his last resort.
Think I punched out, do you?
Armstrong did. Oh, wait.
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
Cool chapter. Cool fight.
Did the AC-20 round get retconned later, where it's not described as more of a, like, flechette shot?
You have to understand that AC-20 is kind of a vague, like, amalgamation. And this is a very good question. That's why in those descriptions, I'm always like, oh, it's like class 10 autocannon or whatever. Because it's not real nomenclature. Because it's trying to, like, kind of designate a lethality for a weapon system that, like, probably fits into more of a gradient, right? Where it's like, oh, some AC-20s are going to be, like, lower caliber weapon systems that fire very rapidly, where some AC-20s might just be one giant hunkin' cannon, right? And so I imagine that we're getting this look at the Pontiac 100 autocannon, and we kind of learn that it's, oh, this is one of those rapid fire cannons. And that quick shot he takes is kind of this like rapid fire burst that makes it seem like it's kind of the shotgun round, is kind of my take on it.
Now, that's interesting because I could see people like me who've played the video games and have just stepped foot into the fiction could see that and have that same thought. So it's good to know, because I'm sure we'll get a lot more descriptions of different weapon fire.
Yeah, you're right. They come in all shapes and sizes. I do know MechWarrior 5 tries to show this through giving you, like, the option of burst fire autocannons versus the, like, single-shot autocannons. But you're right, most games just kind of do one or the other.
It's cool. It totally paid off, though. Good call, putting the AC-20 in there. And that's another one. Number 4, in the dirt. Let's go. We're going to get them all. We're coming for Capet.
Justin's on a heater.
He's on a heater. Another one down.
Always bet on Justin.
And Gray Noden told us that if we won, he'd have a little treat for us.
That's right, Kanan. A trip to the Halls of Valor.
And we'll have to find out how the night on the town goes in the next chapter.
Chapter 23. We open with Justin and Gray hanging out in the locker room. Gray is telling Justin that he thinks that it was pretty risky to replace his autocannon with a bigger autocannon, along with also removing his long-range missiles. He's kind of getting a little, he's like, what are you, dumb?
Noten, you just can't please him. Yeah. He's like, the Centurion sucks. It has long-range missiles. And Justin's like, well, I put a bigger gun in it. He's like, why'd you do that?
Yeah, he tells him, that might work in the factory arena, but in most other arenas, your opponent will just outrange you and kill you with PPCs and long-range missiles.
He's right.
I just like to think that Justin's sitting there looking at him and going like, yeah, that's why I put it in there for factor.
Yeah, exactly. We take the arena into consideration when choosing our loadouts. I do love that in this scene, we get these shots of Justin grooming himself after getting out of the shower. He takes care to wrap the towel around him. I just think it's cool that we get to see a couple shots of this Justin like living with his disability. Like he takes the comb and locks his hair comb like in his left hand. And Justin defends himself to Gray by saying that the risk he took was calculated and intentional. And they're kind of going back and forth. But this is where the old bookmaker shows up with his two goons. Because remember, Justin refused the fix and won the fight. So they tell him, hey, you lost his money. And Justin's like, no, I didn't. You lost you money. I told you.
He's been honest with them the whole time. And they're like, now we're going to break your legs.
Yeah. He told him he wasn't going to throw the fight.
The bookie looks over at him and he's like, I brought two goons.
Two goons.
Two goons do make a right in a bookie's eyes.
The text says that. It says goons.
Yes, they do. We got official goonery.
And so the bookie orders his goons to attack Justin. So, no, it's awesome. In like one fluid motion, jump kicks the one dude, snaps the other guy's arm, and then he like grabs the dude. And they're like, you get the shot of them really close up against the wall, breathing heavy. And he's like holding him. And he's like, you come after me again, I'll kill you. It should also be noted that Justin never drops the comb the whole time. At the end there, when he's talking to the guy, he brings up his left hand in like a dramatic gesture, and he realizes that he's still holding his hair comb. And he's like, oh man, I wish I dropped that. Dude, it is cool.
The 90s is alive in this chapter.
It's very funny.
This fight scene, it rules.
The bookie should have brought better goons.
More goons would have also been more goons. Maybe
that would also help.
More goons.
We need goons in Panther numbers.
Yep, or larger caliber goons.
That's right. Pontiac 100 goons.
So dude's like, all right. He gathers up his goons. He goes to leave. Justin tells them he never wants to see them again. And if he does, he'll kill them. Same thing he tells everyone. And Justin and Gray, they wait for them to finish dragging their friend out of the room before continuing their conversation. And after the men leave, Gray asks Justin if pissing them off was really the right thing to do here. Isn't he like, oh, you said that you're shrewd. How shrewd was that? You just kind of made those dudes really mad. I don't know. Seems like maybe that'll cause trouble down the road. But Justin tells them that, well, you see, it's definitely guaranteed to make Fed rats more angry. And that the battles here, as you know, Gray, they are just as much spectacle as they are anything else. And so if I want good fights, big purses, I got to play the villain. And you realize that Justin has turned heel.
Justin's acclimatized real fast, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's doing great. My man is thriving. This is his villain era.
He's like, I got you, Solaris.
This is where Gray asks Justin if making Fed rats mad is why he's taken up with Kim. And Justin tells him that, yes, he is aware that seeing a woman from the Federated Suns with the Capellan probably makes some dudes mad, but he also points out that Kim used him for the same reasons.
So he's right? Like, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. He's like, yeah. But you see, Brent, they are both exiles, and through this shared experience, they share a bond.
It's like his weakness is that he cares too much.
Tragic. This is where Justin tells Gray that he might actually be in love with her.
It's been a long month.
It's been wild.
Noten says something that I think is interesting here. He's like, I envy you. He hits him with the, like, I'm in love with Kim, I think. And he's like, I envy you, kid. There's a lot of feelings going around here.
I love it. Just two bros
some time has passed, right? It does feel like these guys are closer.
Totally. Yeah, they're tight.
They're more like they're homies now.
They're homies.
Which, as I read that, and as we open up that last chapter and Gray's hanging out, it makes you ask that question, like, what is he angling at? Like, what's the play here? Because it seems pretty destructive for him to have palled up with Justin. But from all we've gotten about Gray so far, is there has to be a reason. There has to be an angle he's working. Because otherwise, he wouldn't do something like this.
Oh, do you think that maybe he's got like a little guilt? He feels like he needs to help him a little bit because of what he did?
See, I took it that as a much colder side of Gray, that this is very calculated.
Yeah.
And like, if I can establish trust with this guy.
Yeah.
When it all does come out, I can strike him from a place that he's weak from.
Good point. You're right. Gray is a sociopath. That's been like established. He's like,
yes,
he's not a good person.
He's a mercenary, but not like in the general way we throw the word mercenary around. I mean, he's a mercenary as a person. Maybe I could use like a better word or something.
A personary.
A personary.
Well, sure. Personary. Gray Notin's a person. We'll go with sociopath.
Gray tells Justin that Kim's bringing the typhoon around. Next stop, Valhalla.
We're on our way back to the Valhalla Club.
We're whipping the typhoon. We got the gold wing doors, dude. We're going to Valhalla. This is sweet. In Solaris, can you imagine whipping a typhoon around Solaris 3027, bro? Come on.
It's a good time.
When they arrive at Valhalla, however, it is not a party. In fact, everyone is sitting around looking sad. And they've draped a black cloth over Armstrong's chair. Gray Notin sees all this and he thinks it's hilarious. He starts laughing. He starts shouting. He's like, is this Valhalla or a funeral home? And it's so disrespectful.
It's funny considering, if we recall, when he's entering the Valhalla Club, he describes it as kind of the living dead.
He does. Yeah, I thought that too.
And then the first thing he does is come in and just antagonize everyone.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
Philip Capetta is here, and he sees Notin. He sees Justin, and he gets mad. He tells Gray Notin, he's like, you got a lot of nerve bringing Justin here. And this is where he stands up, and Capet, he announces to everyone that Justin is the Capella traitor who killed Armstrong. And he tells everyone that Justin is a coward. Oh, but Justin tells him that, Capet, you, most of all, have no business calling me a coward. Because he's looking around, and he's like, oh, I'm guessing that you haven't shared the details of your past with your friends here. All that stuff that happened back in the military.
Justin goes straight for the throat right out of the gate here.
Yeah.
Which is very funny that if we take the scene earlier, the first time we were in Valhalla, with Notin and Capet, and Notin went straight for his throat as well. So they both walk back in here. We get the sequel to it. And man, Capet's just having a rough time anytime he tries to call someone out.
Yeah, he needs to stop doing this.
Capet responds, right? He's like, no one's going to listen to you. We saw the trial, which for me is basically like, why don't you tell all of your friends that you have some deep, dark secret that Justin actually knows the truth about by reacting like that?
Yeah.
It's like, you could have lied.
He could have been like, I don't know where you're talking about, Cappy scum or something. You know what I mean? Like, we already know Capet's not the brightest.
No. Instead, he tells him that they all saw the trial. They saw how he abandoned his men to an ambush and how his father admitted he was a spy. No one's ever going to believe anything he says. You're like, oh, that I did think that's funny. It's like, oh, they all watched the trial. They put it up on the TV. That is funny to think like, oh, everyone on Solaris saw the trial, dude. That's embarrassing.
It makes sense what Justin's doing, though, right? Like, I'm sure Justin's not an idiot, right? He sees the writing on the wall, maybe even on the television. This villain arc starts to make a lot of sense now, if you think about it. He probably doesn't have a chance at, like, a redemption arc here on Solaris. What he does have is the potential to do a little villainry.
No, yeah, he saw a gimmick and he took it right away.
It's a great bit. And this is where Justin calls him out. He's like, all right. So he asks Capet, he says, so when are you going to come after me? Well, let's just cut to the chase. Let's do it. Come on. Capet doesn't get a chance to answer because Wolfson jumps up and he tells Justin that he won't get a chance to fight Philip because Wolfson will destroy him himself. He's like, don't worry about it. I'll kill you myself. And Wolfson tells Justin that the only reason he defeated him the first time was because he took Fa Teng's place.
Way to like leave your cheek out there for the punch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Justin replies that, oh, you mean that I put up a fight? Is that what you mean? And Wolfson is ashamed. He's like, yeah, you're right. And he sits down.
We did learn from this that the gimmick of the Capellan Mafia is to walk up to somebody and hold your arms out and say, take your best shot. And yeah. Turns out people do.
Yeah.
Well, actually, clearly it's been working for them. So people don't, except for Justin and Noten.
Justin and Noten.
Wolfson tells Justin that he will kill him, that he can rig up his mech any way he wants. It doesn't matter. And Justin agrees, but he reminds him to not be as stupid as Armstrong. Wolfson's like, huh? What do you mean? And Justin tells him, don't believe what Capet says is the mark of a man. And that's when he puts his arm around Kim, and Justin, Kim, and Gray, they all kind of like slide into Gray's personal booth there.
They leave just as the conversation was getting stale, right?
Yeah. But I think what he's saying here is that Armstrong didn't eject, right, yeah, when he should have. And Wolfson didn't want to eject either, but he did anyway, and he was shamed for it. And that they kind of have this, like, tough guy thing going on, where it's like, you know, real mech warriors don't eject.
That's a very good point. Basically, he's like, I will kill you if you are stupid.
Yeah.
You're right.
And Wolfson just goes, huh? I don't understand.
But we're done here. We're all, you know, we're hanging out in the booth now. We're tired of them. And so we're back in the little personal booth. We've been here before. We got the HoloVision screen up in the alcove. I like, this is where Gray tells Justin that he maintains a library of all the fights here and that Justin is free to use his catalog if he would like. He's like, you can just come here and watch videos and stuff, you know, tape dogs, you know, watch some tape.
I'm sure Stackpole's writing this for absolutely no reason.
Oh, this is where a server arrives with the bottle of wine and the note in Capellan. Gray's like, I can't read it. It's in Capellan.
Justin says, how convenient. I can read Capellan.
Right. So Justin reads it and the note says, the honor of the House of Jiang rises like the sun. My compliments. Signed, Sun Sheng. Justin's like, I don't know this guy. And he looks at Gray and he's like, this a friend of yours? And Gray's like, oh yeah, I know that guy. The server does mention, he's like, hey, you should know, this wine, this is from Palos. Not only is it the best Capella has to offer, it's the best in the successor states. This is like one of the best bottles of wine you can get. The server tells him that Mr. Shang has to ship it here personally because they can't get it. Valhalla Club can't get it. You know, Shang has, he has a personal connection. This is cool. They all share a toast in Justin's honor. The wine is very good. Everyone loves it. Oh, this is where Justin remembers someone on Spica offering 3 bottles of this wine to ransom his damaged Valkyrie. So, I mean, 3 bottles of this is like as much as a mech.
Yep.
In this era, a Valkyrie is going for 2,205,320 C-bills. So about 1 million C-bills a bottle. That's some expensive-ass wine. That's what that is.
Justin says that Sen Shang must be very well connected. And Gray confirms that, yes, he in fact owns 2 heavy mechs, but lacks a pilot. And Justin, of course, suggests that he should meet with this man because, of course, he'll be needing a heavy mech if he's going to kill Philip Capet. Bum,
bum, bum. I do like to think through this scene as they're sitting in the booth and the server comes up with the note that Gray Noten's thinking like, nah, you don't got to go meet that guy. Like, don't worry about that.
Don't worry about that guy.
That guy's not going to have anything useful for you or any information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There might be some sweat in the booth.
Yeah.
This is like, oh, are you okay?
I did think, like, we've got two people here now making psychopath choices of like, oh, that guy we maimed, let's get in touch with him. Let's see how he's doing.
Yeah.
Let's invite him into our lives.
Hit him up. How's he doing?
It's like they could have just left him to struggle on Solaris and watched him wash out. And they're like, no, we're going to build this guy up into a real threat.
This is my bud. It's Justin.
It's Justin.
He doesn't know.
He's the kind of guy I could give a hand to any day.
Cool chapter. I like the Solaris locker room. I was like, heck yeah, dude. Mech Warrior locker room.
I was excited we got some official goonery.
Yeah, he did. It said goons.
Like I said, I do feel like Stackpole is just cranking up that relationship tension now. And as I was going through it, that's all I could think about. It's like, what's the angle here? Like,
what angle is there not tension coming from, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You have Contessa, who's a spy for...
Well, she's definitely not a spy.
Definitely
Lestrade
not a spy.
Lestrade told us so.
And we don't know who she's definitely not a spy for yet. So we've got this, and all of this is dramatic irony, right? We know that the guy who took Justin's arm from him is also this guy that's become his bud, Gray Noten. We also know Gray Noten, probably not actually his friend, probably some ulterior motives because he's a bit of a socio, nay, psychopath. So yeah, where's there not tension? Oh, and then Justin's going and picking fights with anyone that will accept his toss of the glove. Justin's digging a bit of a hole.
Yeah.
Digging may not even be the right word. He's in it, and he's not putting the shovel down.
And he wouldn't be able to see that either, because where would you even start to suspect somebody who took you under their wing right off the bat and anything? Like, what possible connection to the ambush that completely uprooted his life to somebody on the Solaris 7 game world? And it just so happens that the two people he's now come in contact to in his new heel turn lifestyle happen to be the ones that put it all together.
He's drowning in the water and Noten offered him his hand. It's wild, dude. We're in a weird spot. Stackpole has taken us on a strange journey.
Yep.
And Justin has gotten himself in some trouble.
But at least he'll have Kim to fall back on. And we'll have to see what she's up to in the next chapter.
Chapter 24. This chapter begins with Kim slipping out of bed next to a passed out Justin.
Saucy.
We see her, she gets dressed and slips out of the apartment, and she gets in her car, the Hurricane.
It's pretty clear here that Justin's passed out, not necessarily because he drank too much, but maybe more so that Kim added a little something extra to his drink the night before.
Yeah.
Which means he did pass out from drinking too much.
He's right.
You know what? Damn you, Aaron. Before she gets dressed up, it's clear from the description that she's trying to hide her features. She's tucking her blonde hair up into a hat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very suspect right now.
Kim's suspicious.
Like, I straight up drug Justin and he's passed out. I'm going to go out in disguise and I'm sure it's all done with good intention.
We see her drive to this apartment building. She parks her Hurricane and gets out. She goes up to the front door. We watch her. She hits some buttons on the call box in this kind of sequence, like hits two and waits and hits three. The buzzer goes off and she slips in. She gets into the lobby, but she doesn't go in. She doesn't take the elevator or anything. She immediately like dips to the side and sneaks out the fire door. She ends up slipping into the alley behind the apartment building. And so she goes walking up the street. She stops in front of this restaurant for a second. She kind of like, oh, this looks nice. Oh, cool. Takes a moment, looks at the menu. She's like, oh, I think I'll go in here. So she goes in and takes a seat at one of the booths, right? And she's sitting there. We hear a voice speak to her from a speaker hidden in the cushions behind her head. And we hear a man's voice ask her for a report. And you're like, oh no, dude, I think Kim's a spy.
Lestrade was wrong?
He was wrong.
Very reliable, Lestrade. Poor one out. He was wrong.
I do like how Stackpole took this moment to just be like, just in case you missed my hints, this woman just might be a spy.
Well, we learned some things, huh?
Kim responds. She reports that she has made contact with Shang and that Noten is interested in Justin Jiang and that Justin is also susceptible to this drug that she put in his drink. And so you're right. She totally drugged Justin. She even tells him, I put it in there earlier in the evening. He was also very suggestible under its influence. So she was kind of guinea pigging Justin. I feel like this isn't the first one she's tried. She's been through a few of them till she found one that really hit different. And so the voice replies, the man suggests that she continue encouraging Jiang's entry into Noten's service. And the voice also tells her to be aware that Fa Teng on Justin's crew is Maskrovka. You hear the guy tell her that the minister would hate for you to find it expedient to kill his son. And you're like, oh, dude, she's totally a spy from the Fed Sons. How crazy? It's not that crazy.
It's actually not that crazy. In fact, all of this is starting to make a lot more sense.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, here's the cool part. Because when Kim returns to her car, we see that Gray Noten has been watching her. And this chapter ends with Gray thinking to himself that Kim may have fooled Lestrade into thinking she was nothing more than a bored rich girl. But she didn't fool him, and that will cost her more than she wants to know.
Ooh. Well, that's ominous.
This chapter really like sunk everything together against Justin. We knew it was coming, but now it just feels dangerous. Like everybody just around now? Him is completely working against him.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stackpole has expertly woven. This is, I mean, honestly, a callback to Grayson. Like, it really feels like in some of those situations where Grayson is just like, all of the odds are stacked against him. Stackpole's gotten us here. Justin has nothing. Although the difference is Justin doesn't even know all the odds are stacked against him. He's like nescient, ignorant even, to like the level of danger he's in. He doesn't care. He's so emotionally charged about everything that self-preservation really seems to have kind of been left in the past.
Well, like I said earlier, for me it seems like by Justin going to Solaris 7, it feels like he was making that choice to leave a lot of that behind him. Like he was just going to go live a life on his own terms after getting burned by the Fed Sons.
Yeah, but people that want that, they go be farmers somewhere, right? Like they borrow money, they get land, they go like grow corn on some like periphery world. The people that want to actually be left alone. They don't go to like Solaris and go on a killing spree.
Well, we also know that Justin doesn't have an identity outside of being a mech warrior.
That's true.
So he went to a place where he could continue it. But I could see where he wouldn't have his hackles up about this. Because to his knowledge, he's just come in contact with a Solaris mech warrior. He's dating a daughter of a Federated Sons wealthy person. And he's working alongside a poor Capellan stable. And now it's just like, oh no, he somehow landed in the middle of everything.
It's really got some man who knew too little energy for me, right? He's just in this spot right now, and he can't even see what he's in.
And Stackpole has expertly set that up.
You can't look away. It's so easy to turn the next page because of that, right? You're just like, what's happening? What's going on? What's going to happen?
And this is just the Justin story arc that we're talking
about. This is just the Justin arc. You're right.
Justin's a smart guy, though. Don't underestimate him.
Please don't get it cross. I do think his emotions are clouding his better judgment, but Justin has demonstrated that while he be nescient and ignorant to some of the danger he's in, he definitely can handle himself and think on his feet. That is been made abundantly clear.
that I feel the same way about, is that all these people each are setting up a different trap for Justin to fall into. But as you were just saying, Justin being smart, I feel like once he senses the trap, he may not be the person you want to be on the other end of.
But I think you're barking up the right tree, though.
But Justin shows that when somebody's coming after him, he's not one to shy away from it, and he'll go straight back at them.
He certainly goes through the throat every time.
Exactly. Justin Jiang is a dangerous man. It is true, the ones around him who are potentially taking advantage of him, they should be careful as well. So far, he's demonstrated a near limitless capacity for vengeance.
He's a dangerous man in a dangerous place.
I just mean, Kim better hope he doesn't find out. But now that we know, that Gray knows, the only question is, will he tell Justin?
Well, we certainly learned a lot about the people that surround Justin on Solaris 7. We'll have to find out if he has any true friends left out there in the next chapter.
Chapter 25. This chapter begins with Arden Sortek and Andy Redburn arriving on Tharkad. Huh? We're like, oh yeah, you know, we're touring the stars with the boys.
The A-boys.
Yeah, I love this. So we open with a shot of their dropship landing on this snow-covered spaceport, and we see a gantry rises from the surface.
Gantry?
Yes. And a gantry comes up off the surface of the thing and like docks with the ship so that the guys can get on it and like an elevator can take them down. And I was like, right, it is here that we are reminded that gantries can not only hold mechs, but they can also hold men.
Huh? God. I do like Arden here is like, damn it. Why the hell can't I ever visit Tharkad when it's not freezing cold?
Yeah.
It's always winter when Arden shows up.
So they're going down the elevator. Andy is visibly nervous about meeting the Archon, but Arden helpfully reminds him that they are meeting not only the Archon, but the Archon designate and the whole of the Lyran Commonwealth Court. And Andy's like, oh, yeah, thanks, dude.
I can always count on you.
There's spaghetti actively falling out of this man's pockets.
It's true.
As I was saying last episode, he's not used to all this brass being around. And now that they're showing him off like some prize dog.
He's a stud.
He's going to have to get used to it, it looks like.
At least he's got Arden to learn from along the way.
That's right.
We get a good look at their uniforms here. Andy is wearing green with silver trim. And Sortek is wearing a blue uniform with gold trim. They look very similar, but they're different, like, color combinations. It says, Andy's uniform reflects he's a Capellan March unit. That's why he's green and silver. I thought that was cool.
It's a cool little bit of lore we get dropped here. It's like, oh, there's slightly different uniforms for each march, it seems.
They both have this sunburst design. It says it starts at the left shoulder and has four rays extending out and down to the middle of the jacket, creating a brilliant asymmetrical double breast. We got tight-fitting trousers tucked snugly into cavalry boots and rowless spurs, remnants of an ages-old cavalry tradition in the mark of a mech warrior in the Federated Suns. And you're like, oh, they wear spurs on their boots.
It's a cavalry tradition. There's some units in modern militaries, even to this day, that do indeed wear spurs, at least with like dress uniforms.
That's cool. Mech warriors in the Federated Suns wear spurs on their boots. Huh. I like that. So they take the elevator down to the ground where they are met by Archon Katrina Steiner and her daughter, Archon Designate Melissa Steiner. The Archon tells Arden that it's good to see him again, and she asks if he remembers her daughter. Arden laughs and draws Melissa into a hug. Oh, he says that she's the best nurse an ailing mech warrior ever had.
Gives us a little peek into the history they got.
Also, Arden's got this big uncle energy, right? You could just see him just like, like,
yeah,
it's great. I love it.
Yeah, where everybody there is feeling that little bit of tension. He comes in with the icebreaker straight out the bat.
Yeah.
Yes. He gets a good look at her, grabs her and holds her out a little bit. And he's like, ah, yes, you've become lovelier than ever in the 2 years since they last met. And you're like, oh, okay. So he was here 2 years ago. And Melissa tells him that she also misses the time they spent together while he recuperated here. But she is glad that he has not again needed her ministrations. She says ministrations. And yeah, right here, this is one of the first instances we get where they refer to Sortek's previous time here on Tharkat. It's not the first time it comes up, but yeah, we see here that Melissa helped him in some way, like waited on him. They're making these allusions to her acting as his nurse, her ministrations.
For the record, ministrations, okay, a noun, the act of process or serving or aiding, the act of performing the duties of a cleric, and or the act of ministering or serving, semicolon, service. That's what ministrations are.
It's like Bloodborne, blood ministration. Shout out to Bloodborne. Arden introduces Andrew Redburn. Melissa asks Andy how someone so courageous on the battlefield can be so baffled in a social situation.
Poor Andy, like called out on the carpet immediately.
This is why he's a hero. Arden goes to like help him save face, but Andy does. He's like, I got this. And he pulls this one out. He tells her that on a battlefield, if he doesn't know what else to do, he can always just start shooting. And everyone laughs. Good one, Andy.
At least he's taken this time with Arden to learn some lessons along the way.
He killed it. He did.
Feel a great deal of relation to Andy.
He did good.
It was kind of one of those like failing success.
Yeah.
I don't feel like he was prepared for it to be as humorous.
He had the confidence, though. Right. Yeah,
I can only imagine he had like 1,001 introductions to the Archon ready, like coming off the dropship, right. And yeah. Arden sank every single one of those immediately.
The Rolodex was going, and it was like anything appropriate, and then it was like this response is the one that popped up, and he was like, what? It just happened to work for him.
He did great.
Who uses a Rolodex anymore?
The Archon leads them all down into the maintenance facility underground and invites them all to board this hovercraft, right? There's this whole scene and they all get in the hovercraft and they all sit down. But once inside, right, Melissa and the driver switch places. There's like this driver, they have a hat on. You know, we haven't seen their face. This is where the driver removes their cap and it is revealed that the driver the whole time was the true Melissa Steiner. And then we realize as the reader, we're like, oh, the one that Andy was talking to is actually Gina Clay.
It does make the scene where Sortek holds her at arm distance and goes, let me get a look at you. It makes that scene a little bit more funny in hindsight.
Yes.
Yeah.
What a weird way to reveal this thing. Right?
It is like, very theatrical, now that you mention it.
It's a little over the top, and also seems a little hasty. Like, if Arden was like, oh, by the way, don't tell anything to Andy, he's not cool at all.
Right.
He tells all of our secrets immediately, and it's like, no, but we have this whole cool driver switch plan.
Yeah, there is some, like, OPSEC here that I'm like, I don't know, man, like, maybe we should have waited just a little longer.
Yeah, why was Melissa even on site, right? Doesn't that seem like a security issue? Yeah. She didn't have to be here.
I mean, we learned, if you remember in Decision at Thunder Rift, it's very easy for a dropship to get all the way to the ground before you're like, it's actually surprise pirates. I'm sure that there's actually like lots of clearances over Tharkad being the capital and all, so maybe a little bit of exaggeration there on my part. I think I really just wanted to say surprise pirates.
But we also know here is that Stackpole just wanted you to know that the body double thing was a success. And he wanted to tell you immediately. He did not want to wait on that at all.
Now, I did want to point out that Gina Clay, as Melissa, in that previous scene, was able to correctly recall all of these details of her life with Arden Sortek, something that she wasn't there for.
Which is very impressive already. We were poking fun, but this really like comes back around to like the way Stackpole likes doing business, right? He's taken a short time to explain a lot of things to you, and he's kind of left it up to you to be smart enough to keep up, right? And so there is that, like, oh, in hindsight, that makes her whole act, as Kanan was saying, very impressive. Gina indeed was a good candidate, it seems.
Nice. This is where we jump forward to a scene of all the same characters, plus Simon Johnson, now standing in the Archon's office. Remember, Simon Johnson, that was the intelligence director.
Yeah, the man in charge of Lick.
Yes. Does anyone... no one says Lick, right? Do they? Is that a thing?
I don't think so.
They've confused me now.
I had to do it to him.
I don't like that.
The Lyrans should have had better acronyms there.
Arden is congratulating Simon on such a good job with the body double. He's like, wow, you killed it. It does creep him out a little bit because of the whole situation with Hans.
It's kind of a creepy situation.
Yeah. I mean, he's like, oh, yeah, Arden is like, oh, another body double. Interesting.
Oh, no. Another body double.
How far are the successor states going to take this thing?
Simon claims that he didn't really do anything at all. It was Gina who has done all the work because she is a volunteer, and that makes her superior in her job.
This kind of alludes back to the psychology around the body doubles, as we talked about earlier. You know, the problem with the body double for Hans was brainwashed, right? And so eventually, though, his like underlying psyche that wasn't actually Hans kind of came bursting through the surface.
It's like being John Malkovich, but it's being Hans Davion. When Simon mentions Gina's job, they both kind of look over at Andy, and Arden kind of gives him a motion like he doesn't know. He's like, yeah, he doesn't know about the, there's like a little exchange there where like Simon's like, is he cool? And like Arden's like, not yet, hold up. We know he's telling them that he doesn't know about like the wedding and all that stuff. Gina's dismissed. She leaves the room. And we get a little scene where Arden Sortek is talking to Melissa, the real Melissa. Now, Melissa is expressing to Arden this sense of inferiority she feels when comparing herself to Gina, right? There's this whole thing where she's like, she's just so much better than me. She's so much cooler and smarter. She's like a mech warrior and stuff.
I love that Stackpole puts this little bit in here. I think it's very human, right?
Yeah. Even as we learn in this discussion, especially because Melissa's 16, and imagine being a teenager and then having somebody be you and then taught to perform everything that you do. You'd look at it and feel very weird about it.
And then they're spending literally every free time trying to be the best you they can possibly be. It's intimidating, right? Someone's perfecting to be you.
Melissa admits that she often wonders if, when the time comes, she should just let Gina rule in her place. Arden asks her why she thinks that Gina would be more fit to rule. And this is where Melissa tells him that Gina is a mech warrior, just like her mother. And her mother's mother, all the Archons are mech warriors. And we learn that Melissa is not a trained mech warrior. She says she was too skinny, and so she was trained in infantry instead. Melissa expresses admiration for Gina's willpower and discipline. And she claims the depth of Gina's sacrifice is evidence of her worthiness. She really believes it. She feels inferior to her body double. She's having this whole heart-to-heart with Arden Sortek here.
It makes you wonder if this whole body double thing is a good idea after all.
And this is where Andy approaches, because he's here to tell Colonel Sortek that the Archon needed him. But Andy walks up and he admits that he overheard some of what Melissa was saying, right? And bravely, Andy expresses sympathy for what the Archon designate was talking about. And Arden's like, oh, dude, really? What a brave move. Andy walks up and he's like, I think I know what she was saying. And Arden's like, oh, big swing, dude. They have a moment where I feel like they kind of like glance at each other. He's like, you sure you want to take this? And Andy's like, I got this. And so he's like, oh, I invite, please share your thoughts. And it says in the text here, Arden inwardly admires his courage. He's like, this is the most courageous thing you've ever done, Andy. And so Arden walks off to talk to the Archon, and it's Andy standing here next to Melissa. This is where Andy's like, all right, I'm going in. And we get this whole bit where Andy admits to Melissa that he too struggles with the burden of leadership, and he has this whole thing where he describes the difficulty of training cadets, knowing that he'll be sending some of them to their death, and all that, you know, the whole burden of leadership. He brings up a good point. I do think it's sad. He's like, you know, some of these guys are going to go and die in their like first combat engagement, right? And it's hard. He thinks about it, right? Andy, he's like, man, sometimes I wonder if I'm teaching them just enough to get them killed. And he feels terrible about it. It's this burden.
It's a reasonable thing to feel bad about. They have this heart to heart here over the burden of leadership, right? It seems like we get kind of a like, oh, these two are going to be friends.
He does great. He gives her this whole thing about the burden of leadership. It's beautiful. And Melissa asks him how he is able to shoulder such a burden. And he tells her that he does the best he can because he knows others would do worse. Andy tells her that people need someone to bear their responsibility so that they can get on with whatever it is they need to do. And Melissa asks him how she knows that she'll be able to stand up to the pressure.
I love this answer here.
No one can really know until the time comes, right? And you either fall or you don't.
But then he leans in with the people that ask the question in the first place are usually the ones that are going to succeed.
Boom.
I totally agree with him.
Absolutely. He kills it. He does huge swing from Andy. He's 2 for 2. He's doing great.
So much socializing.
He was sweating. He was sweating coming down that elevator. But yeah, Grayson could never.
I actually think Grayson would do fine because courage and stupidity are it's a thin line. And I think he'd just be himself. And so he'd be fine, foolishly fine, if you will. That's my guess. We'll have to see, though. Maybe we'll get a meeting with the Archon and Grayson at some point. Who knows?
Maybe indeed. But as I was reading this, I did have a moment where I was like, Arden took such a huge gamble on this moment between Andy and Melissa.
Yeah.
Because she was clearly setting this up of like, I'm having a lot of doubts. This is going to be an important moment of self-definition for Melissa. And he's like, you're up, Andy. Andy could have come in here and said like, oh, I find the best way to deal with it is just crush anyone that comes across my desk. I would rather put down a problem than ever face one.
Like you see, you know, you can't forget, you got to be tough or whatever.
You're right. Our boy, Andy here, it turns out the Hunchback hasn't rung his bell hard enough for him to not give this good ass answer.
But no, I mean, Andy does great with it, but that's all I could think of as I wrapped it up of like, what if he had said something terrible and the future Archon would have this framework to go off of?
Are you saying that poor Andy was for a moment there, shouldering the responsibility of the entire Lyran Commonwealth?
For just a moment.
It's not over, though, because they have a party to go to, right? That's what the Archon says. I think earlier in the chapter, she says that she's going to throw them to the social wolves. So we're just getting warmed up.
That's what this whole thing's about, a shindig.
And we'll have to find out what Andy and Arden can get up to in the next chapter.
Chapter 26. We find ourselves in the grand ballroom on Tharkad, and it is Katrina Steiner's great pleasure to welcome us all here this evening. Katrina also offers a toast to our esteemed visitors from the Federated Suns, who both look uncomfortable with the attention. Everyone raises a glass, but Frederick Steiner and Duke Aldo Lestrade raise theirs a little slower.
Well, we know who's going to be our trouble party of the night.
We're going to learn that these two are some stinkers.
Another Lestrade. This is the Lestrade father, that rich guy on Solaris. Yeah, this is his dad.
Well, and we know he's been a hit so far, so we'll see how far that apple falls from the tree.
Arden Sortek raises his glass and offers a toast in the name of Prince Hans Davion. A toast wherein the prince praises the beauty, valor, and intelligence of the Steiner women and declares his hope that Steiner women will continue to lead the Commonwealth for the foreseeable future. And this, too, upsets Duke Frederick and Duke Lestrade.
That's a strange thing to upset someone, isn't it? Weird. I wonder what their motives are.
They're so mad. Melissa introduces Lieutenant Redburn to a man named Baron Seffens. Baron Seffens is Duke Michael Hasek Davion's representative on Tharkad. And Andy's never heard of the Baron, but the Baron has heard of Andy. Baron Seffens tells Andy that Duke Michael really appreciates what the 1st Kittery Training Battalion has done, and Andy tells him that if that's true, then he has an odd way of showing it, because Andy reminds the Baron that Duke Michael sent a pack of goons to personally ruin Justin's life.
Things are going well.
Andy's sticking up for Justin, though. Here on Tharkad, all the way across the Inner Sphere, still standing up for Justin.
He's ready to throw down on the first person that mentions it there.
It's our boy.
Punches are usually frowned upon in these kind of affairs, however.
Did you see, I like when Melissa introduces them together. She says, you guys are both from the Capellan March, so do you guys know each other? The Capellan March is a large holding. I just thought it was funny because he's right. It's not just, it's like a bunch of different planets.
Well, it's a bunch of different stars with a bunch of different planets around said stars, right? Hundreds of thousands of millions of light years away from each other.
I do like that they'd have to respond, we do know each other, but not because we're both from the Capellan March.
Yeah.
Well, technically it is because they're both from the Capellan March.
The Baron informs Andy that while he and Colonel Sortek have been out here touring the Commonwealth, Justin has been on Solaris doing his best to kill every Fed Sun's mech warrior he can find. And Andy is visibly shocked at this. And the Baron is visibly pleased that Andy is upset. He got him. He's like, oh yeah?
It was almost like it was bait and Andy took it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took it. And now he's shook. He's got him. So Andy takes a hit here. This is when the laser cracks the engine shielding or whatever, or you start, it says, you know, you lose some. Same thing. Meanwhile, Ardan Sortek is introducing himself to the Duke of Duran, Frederick Steiner.
I will say, Duke of Duran has a bit of a ring to it. I kind of dig it.
It's pretty good.
Too bad it's attached to a stinker.
Both men agree that their respective reputations precede them. And this begins one of my favorite little exchanges. This whole next little section is like both of these two dudes like snipping at each other back and forth. And they're both masters, right? Ardan Sortek is like a vet, right? This is not his first time.
Both in and out of the cockpit, it appears.
Yeah, he's been doing this whole like royal court thing for a while now, right? He's kind of gotten the hang of it. He's not afraid. We just get to see two masters at work. I love this scene. So Duke Frederick points out that Ardan's career has left him without any visible scars, unlike him. And this is where we learn that Duke Frederick Steiner has this facial scar, right? Ardan also knows that the Duke is referencing the time that he was hospitalized here on Tharkad. And he also knows that the Duke is unaware of Maximilian Lau's plot to substitute a body double for Hans Davian. I guess he didn't read The Sword and the Dagger, but then again, who did? Ardan responds to the Duke by hypothesizing that his lack of visible scars is probably because he hasn't been doing this as long.
Just throws right back at him.
I think that's called a repose.
That's the second book, isn't it? So in the first round, Frederick is like, oh, you're not as cool as me because you didn't get any cool scars. And Ardan hits him back by saying, like, well, yeah, but you're old. Frederick's like, oh, he's right. Pretty good. Like, this is where Ardan Sortek invites the Duke to, please, call me Ardan. And the Duke doesn't, specifically. This is where Duke Lestrade limps into the chat and begins by declaring that, like the Duke, he too has suffered the physical toll of a career serving in a frontline unit. So Duke Lestrade is now in the conversation. And I do like, he points out, he's like, my friend, the Duke. There's this bit where Arden's like, ah, he's tipping me off that he's not going to do first name basis with me.
This whole thing's got some real Mean Girls energy.
It does. And yeah, you see here that Lestrade swoops in under the guise of like defending Sortek or something, or like kind of like coming in for the save to help him save face. It's masterful.
Sortek really does seem like he's here to stir the pot.
Yeah. We see Duke Lestrade has a prosthetic arm and a prominent limp. Oh, also, we learned that by frontline unit, Duke Lestrade means the streets, because you see, he would have been a mech warrior, but his dad wouldn't let him. Right? He says that. He's like, you know, I'm not a mech warrior, but he's like, my neighborhood's pretty wild. Let me tell you, that's basically what he says.
Listen, everyone out there, the whole, like, I would have X, but Y act, just don't do it. Listen, there's no reason for anyone to ever do that. Just don't do it.
I would have served, but yeah.
Just keep it to yourself.
No, it sets you up to get slapped down just like Arden's about to do.
It should be noted, however, that Duke Lestrade is from Summer, and House Karita loves raiding Summer. Apparently. They love it. They're always raiding Summer.
Me too.
This is where Arden Sortek also points out how tragic it is that everyone ahead of Duke Lestrade in the line of succession has perished in a Karita raid. He points out that it's a bit suspicious.
Convenient, even.
Yeah.
Yeah, very convenient that there would have been people ahead of you in the line of succession, but like they all died in these raids.
It only cost him an arm and a leg.
Yeah, very good. This triggers Duke Frederick when he hears this, because he's also aware that this is a veiled insult.
It's all been veiled insults.
Yes.
Yes.
It's oops, all veiled insults.
There's this whole unspoken game being played. Oh, right. Because this is where Duke Frederick politely requests that the colonel please clarify his statement.
Things are getting rowdy. This is where, in other parts of Thawkhead, I imagine people start removing their shirts.
Yeah.
And asking each other to step outside.
It's too cold. And in a masterful display of what we like to call a plausible deniability, the colonel simply points out that anyone who's a fan of Duke Lestrade's speeches would know that the Commonwealth regularly leaves Summer completely unprotected. So at this point, Duke Frederick looks like he's about to throw hands, right? But like Duke Lestrade has to like get his boy at this point. Dude, Sortek's got him tilted. He gets him. And then, dude, I love this scene. And then right here at like the simmering point, there's a moment where all three men stand in silence for a moment while a passing server like refills all their glasses, like one by one, just in the middle of their little thing. Like they just kind of stand there and look at each other while like this guy like, oh, excuse me, sir. And so now they all have their glasses have been refilled. This is where Colonel Sortek offers a polite suggestion to Duke Lestrade. Perhaps he is simply underestimating the strength of defense present in his region, most likely because he never went to mech warrior school. He tells the Duke about how he recently hung out with the Kellhounds and they like repulsed a raid by the Second Sword of Light. He tells him, he's like, the Kellhounds are good. They should be good enough. They're in your region. This is where the Duke, now he gets all big picture with it. He's telling Sortek that the problem with mech warriors like him is that they don't think big enough. He tells him, he's like, it's more than just a game.
He's hitting him with the old, listen, you're thinking tactical. We need you to think strategic. And you know, it's just like all you mech warriors to only think tactically.
Yeah. He's lecturing him about how military actions like raids, they create hardship and suffering for the people who live there. And that when you only think in military terms, it's easy to lose perspective of that. And Arden, of course, just begins like cackling. It like startles the two Lyran Dukes because he's just like, ha, 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 ha. Like slapping his belly, you know?
Hell yeah.
He's like slapping him on the shoulder. And he's like, that's so funny because I've been sent here for that exact reason. He tells Duke Lestrade, you sound just like Hans Davion.
Hook, line, and sinker.
It's so funny. My Duke, yeah, that's the reason he sent me. Exactly what you said. To meet the people, to build bridges, to understand the common man.
This marks the day that Arden Sortek murdered somebody with a compliment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Luckily, Frederick Steiner and Aldo Lestrade love being compared to Hans Davian, right? Yeah, there. It's exactly. It's beautiful. And unfortunately, Colonel Sortek has to go.
He picked his moment to drop the mic.
Yeah, beautiful. He killed him. This shows, though, that Arden Sortek, right, he's been doing, like I said, he's been doing this whole court, like royal court thing for a while. He's been hanging out with Hans.
He's got that dog in him. Let's be honest.
Yes, exactly. He knows how to handle guys like this. He talks to guys like this all the time. He does this all day.
I love how Frederick and Lestrade kind of start to circle him. They smell blood in the water there. They think they're going to just take this dude down before he has a chance to do anything. And Arden just wipes the floor with him. He doesn't get shook. He doesn't miss a step in his stride there. He just slams these two down. And it's like, by the way, I got to get out of here. See y'all later.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, got to go. Hits him with the finger guns.
Yeah.
You know, on his way. Yeah.
Hey, I'll catch you guys later. All right.
Yeah.
Nice talk.
Yeah. Yeah. Colonel Sortek has to go, though, because Andy is drowning. Andy is over there. He's still talking to Baron Seffens when Sortek lays a hand on Andy's shoulder. This prompts the Baron to leave immediately and Andy to unclench his fists.
Andy does not have the same amount of experience as Arden in these worlds.
Yeah, he was just over there taking it, right? Like gritting his teeth, clenching his fists. He's like sweating. Sortek looks over and he's like, oh, hold up.
He's just lobbing spaghetti at people like an angered ape.
Yeah. He doesn't know what to do, though. He's totally locked up, right? He sees him. He's so tense over there. That's when, yeah, Sortek comes in.
Ho-ho, my laddie!
It is funny. As soon as that dude, because remember, that's the guy from the Capellan March. As soon as he sees Arden Sortek, he leaves. Like, he's like, oh, wait, I'm out. So, because he knows who Sortek is. Everyone knows who Sortek is, right? Yeah, he's like, you know what? I'm out. Melissa tells him that he's like a cross to a vampire, but I like Andy says more like salt to a slug. And I like that line.
Andy's so mad.
Yeah. He tells Sortek, he's like, Baron Seffens is, he's as bad as Videos. And Arden, however, reminds him that no one is that bad, Andrew.
And Andrew's he's like, easy.
You're right. Yeah. He agrees. This is where Melissa introduces the boys to Misha Auburn. Misha is Melissa's best friend, and Misha is Thalos Auburn's daughter. Thalos Auburn is the court historian for the Lyran Commonwealth. He's like a really smart guy, and he writes all these books. This is where we get the ballroom. We get a dancing scene here. The girls ask Arden and Andy if they'd like to go dancing. And we see the two men quickly exchange concerned glances, but they both know there is no escape.
These two have had a full day already.
There's going to be a dancing scene. What a good movie this is, right? We get the party scene when he's arguing with the guys, and then, of course, the girls, and they're going dancing.
This is just Stackpole at its best. He crushes these political scenes.
Yeah, I do love these.
Yeah, he's killing it here.
Andy tells Misha that he prays that she is either an able instructor or that her feet will move quickly enough from beneath his. And Misha laughs. So good job, Andy. That was good. That was good. He is. He's good with the jokes. Misha tells him that she hopes he has a mech warrior's legendary agility so that he won't step on her feet. And she says that her dress is very constricting.
These two are immediately hitting it off.
Yeah. On their way out to the dance floor, Misha suggests that if they have a good time dancing, they should enjoy the winter sports tomorrow. She invites him skiing. There's a really cool domed ceiling that's displaying a projection of the night sky. Because it's so snowy, it's like a blizzard outside. But when he looks up, it looks like you're looking out like the window up to the stars, but it's actually a projection.
Spares no expense.
So they're dancing. And he's not bad, though. He likes the music. That helps.
He's feeling it.
He does. He's like, yeah, he's like, oh, this is tight. It's a bop.
Is he doing well, though, or are we just getting Andy's perspective where he thinks he's doing well?
I think he's doing all right. He's doing fine.
Makes you think.
He's honoring the Federated Suns. He is. I just want to say, I'm proud of him. I am, man. He's such a Chad. Andy looks over and he sees that Arden and Melissa are dancing together. And he tells Misha that, oh, it's good to see the Colonel enjoying himself. Misha tells Andy about how Melissa nursed Arden back to health after his trauma on Stein's Folly, and that she's been looking forward to his visit and all this, because they're best friends. They talk a lot. And again, is mentioned that thing from the past. So the music fades.
Yeah, which we got a little clarification from when he was talking to Frederick Steiner, and he's talking about trauma that he faced here.
Yeah, the delusions, the sword and the dagger. So the music fades, and they leave the dance floor. Misha tells Andy that he dances very well, and Andy, of course, gives her all the credit, as he should. Again, kills it, and the chapter ends with, Misha took the glass of champagne that Andrew offered her from the bar and touched it to his glass. To great combinations. Tink.
Chemistry indeed.
I love this party. Stackpole did such a great job.
Yeah.
Setting up just this snippy courtroom conversations.
Courtrooms in courtship. Am I right?
It's a party. It's a Lyran party.
It's a Lyran party. This is Stackpole at his finest. Okay? Stackpole crushes this every time. He's just batting 1,000. Anytime there's just this political jousting and machinations, I don't know what Stackpole's upbringing is or why he has such a handle on this, but I think these last two scenes, the proof in the pudding. And these are just some of his first, right? The best is yet to come.
I love all the high society stuff with the barons and the dukes and the lords and the ballrooms. Yeah, man. The future neo-feudalism, like space opera, ballroom scenes are the best.
I also like how he takes this opportunity to set this stage for BattleTech. Because this book, we've gotten so much court insight into the big houses of the Inner Sphere. And you're seeing that the people making a lot of these calls, the people that are in charge, can be petty. They can be immature in a lot of ways. And when we're bouncing back and forth between mercenary units and the soldiers on the ground fighting these battles, it kind of keeps that in the back of your mind of saying, like, are they fighting over someone's disagreement at a party? Did someone insult somebody and they didn't have a good enough insult back, so now lives are being lost for it?
Are you saying, Aaron, that is both simultaneously humanizing and dehumanizing?
Yes, exactly.
Welcome to BattleTech.
I feel like Stackpole really punches that home with that conversation with Frederick and Lestrade, saying, you have to understand the overall impact of what you're doing. You have to think about how the people are affected by your decisions. And they throw that out there, but they don't seem to really have the capacity to act on what they're saying.
Yeah, he's right. I love this chapter, though. Arden and Andy at the party on Tharkad, and showing like how Arden is like this like vet, you know, he's this pro. And then you have Andy over here. He's this young hotshot. He did good though. I love this. This was cute.
He didn't clap off. That's for sure. The pot was boiling, but he didn't let it boil over.
No, Arden saved him. He did. We don't know where that could have gone. You know, that could have gone poorly, but Arden came in and scared off the Baron.
He's a hero.
He's a hero.
A champion.
Poor Andy. Andy just wanted to go back to Kittery. Get back to work.
He does.
And now this is his life for now.
But yeah, the dancing went well, so they will be going skiing, him and Misha.
And we'll have to see what tomorrow holds for Andy and Misha in the next chapter.
Chapter 27. We open with Arden striding into Andy's suite, his hotel room. And Andy is posted up. He's looking comfy.
He really is.
Yes.
That fit, though.
Yes. He's got a glass of brandy. He is. He's like posted up. The camera pans over and Andy's like on the couch, like with his like sweater on, right? And like, yeah.
He's luxuriating.
Yes, he looks great.
This room, it smells of natural wood fire and mahogany.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so it seems the skiing went well.
They hit the slopes, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I like when Arden asks Misha if Andy did anything to dishonor the Federated Sons. She says no, though. She says he did well. He killed it.
I do like that if Arden doesn't have anyone to antagonize in the room, he defaults to Andy.
Yeah.
As one does.
And Arden has come to collect Andy now, but he tells Misha that he'll have him back within the hour.
This seems to please Misha.
Yes. It's so funny, though. He's like, all right, Andy, let's go. And Andy, he like stands up and he's like, oh, should I change first? And this is where we see, okay, it says he's wearing a thick pullover, blue corduroy knickers, thick wool stockings. He looked far too casual beside Arden's neatly pressed blue uniform. And it's so funny. He looks so comfy. And Arden is in, like, his stuff is, like, he's got the lines in it and everything. It's, like, perfect. It's so funny. Arden's like, it'll be fine. It's fine. Let's go. And they, like, walk out of the room. And then we do a jump cut to Simon Johnson standing next to Arden and Andy. They're sitting in these gray metal chairs. I feel like they're in this, like, white, nondescript room.
Just picture, it's some IKEA looking place. We're on Tharkad.
Yeah. Andy's like, it isn't weird if I wear this. Arden's like, it's fine. And then it cuts to them sitting in the chair, and you see Andy in like the sweater and like the corduroy, and like Simon Johnson's like looking at him. And oh yeah, dude, this is so funny. Simon asks Arden Sortek how much Andy knows. And Andy gets so excited when he sees Arden respond with, he hasn't been briefed. When like Arden says he hasn't been briefed, he like straightens up in his chair. He gets like visibly like, oh man. Because can you imagine?
He's got to collect his spaghetti back.
Dude, I'm like, for real. Imagine getting pulled into a room and then and like somebody's like, how much does he know? And like your boy's like, he hasn't been briefed. I'd be like, let's go. He's like, let's go. I'm about to get briefed. What's up?
You know you're about to hear some crazy stuff right after that.
Yes.
Andy
yes.
Bringing the Michael Scott energy.
He's like, this is the best day of my life. And Johnson pulls up a chair and sits in it backwards. This rules, right? We see him. He pulls the chair over, but flips it.
I'll allow it.
Yes. He flips it, dude. Throws the arms up over the back with the legs.
He wanted to be as casual as Andy. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Johnson assures Andy that he'll do his best to keep it simple. He reminds us that Hans and Katrina signed that treaty 5 years ago, and everyone knows about the treaty.
We know about the treaty. Remember? That treaty at the prologue?
Exactly. But not everyone knows about the secret provisions. Not everyone knows about the wedding. And Johnson tells Andy that what he's about to tell him is only known by a handful of people.
Oh, how exciting.
Andy's like, oh, should I even hear this? Is it okay? You know, does this put me in danger?
It's like, actually, it's G14 classified.
Yeah. Johnson tells him, though, it's probably fine because no one would believe you anyway. So Simon tells Andy about the marriage, of course. He's like, so next year, Hans Davian and Melissa Steiner will be wed on Terra in August, and which absolutely blows his mind. He's like, whoa. It does. He has to like take a second.
It might be because of some of the implications there. Both. There's an age gap, okay? And it means that there'll be the merging of these two nation states, these huge nation states. And also, she's like way younger, dude. That's kind of weird.
Yeah. Simon proceeds to explain that Melissa hasn't actually met Hans since she was a child. And since then, all contact with the prince has gone through Colonel Sortek.
He's been a real, like, keep enough room for Jesus kind of guy. For the whole situation.
Yeah, exactly. But it is not the same as a flesh and blood meeting. This is where Andy nods and says, like fighting in a simulator. And I was like,
it's like, Andy, this is the time where you just don't talk. Like, yeah.
He's just always wagging that little tail, you know yep. what I mean? He's a little Labrador retriever.
He tried. I thought that was so funny. it's like fighting in a simulator. And I'm like, no.
No.
It's not. Simon continues to explain that while he debates the wisdom of this enterprise, both the Archon and her daughter have decided that she should go, while Gina Clay stays behind as Melissa. And you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So the real Melissa is going to travel to New Avalon to hang out with Hans Davion. And then Gina's going to stay here and be Melissa.
Under guise, under some name of her own choosing. For the record, in most clandestine operations, not allowed to pick your name because, well, it's better if someone else comes up with it because you're going to choose something silly.
You're right. This is where Andy realizes that they're asking him to accompany the Archon designate back to the Federated Suns. He's like, oh.
They really just dropped everything on this guy.
Yes.
All at once here.
Because he's like, oh, and Arden's gonna, and they're like, no, Arden's staying here. And he's like, no, I'm gonna. They're like, yeah, you're gonna. And he's like, oh,
man, that spaghetti is just coming right back out. Yeah. Just put it back in there. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The bead of the sweat.
Now the sweater feels silly.
Yeah. He asked Simon, he's like, why don't you guys should just use a Merc company?
They actually had thought about that.
Yeah. They thought of it. But Simon explains that because Andy is so hot right now, everybody's going to want a piece, right? And if they're traveling together, no one will be paying attention to her. Everyone will be paying attention to him, right? He has this whole hypothesis where he's like, you're like a kind of like a B-list celebrity right now. You should, I don't know, is he A-list? How famous can a mech warrior be, right?
I mean, I imagine it depends on how far did those battle realms get burst through, like how viral did those videos go? You know what I mean? Like he could be pretty famous. Hell, maybe even a household name.
For local man saves some stingers, not all of them from cicada ambush.
Well, they are stingers. Like, what can you do?
He saved at least one and people said that's a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you have to remember that this whole thing is a bit of a psyop, right? And so, you know, they are making him out to be a hero. So I imagine they would push that stuff, right? I imagine it's a bit of a propaganda campaign. So if it didn't go viral on its own, they've made it viral, if you will.
Yeah, they're on like a publicity tour.
Everyone's trying to get a piece of that back. That hunchback, you know what I'm saying?
I did wonder as I read this, though, like Simon's explaining that as the plan of like, you're so popular that nobody's going to look at Melissa next to you. And I was like, does that hold up? Is that something where like people are looking?
She plays the Kim card and she puts her hair all up into a hat while it's raining and carries an umbrella.
Yeah, she puts on a pair of Clark Kent glasses that maybe nobody will recognize the future Archon of Lyran Space.
This is where Simon tells him that they're just waiting for Melissa to choose a fake name so that then they can create a whole fake identity. That is weird. Simon should have picked the name, right? You can tell, I bet Simon did want to pick the name.
Yes, we should do what Simon says.
I bet he did. I like there's this one little line where he's explaining this and he's like, against my better judgment anyway, or something, where you realize that he kind of thinks this whole thing is a bad idea.
It's almost like someone pulled the, like, well, I am the Archon's daughter, so...
He just slips in. He's so slick there. He slips in if just one little line where he expresses, like, disapproval.
He's like, I'd hate to do anything that would put our very secretive body double plan at risk.
Yeah.
There's like a story about like the OSS. They actually had to come up with a machine to like name special operations because like somehow people would name them and they would somehow actually give away like some of the properties of the mission. Like no matter what, like it was just kind of this subconscious human thing. And so they actually had a like a random generator.
Oh, of course. So then we cut to a scene of Melissa hanging out with Gina Clay. Both of them are there. Gina looks like Melissa, and so it's kind of like she's hanging out with her own body double. This is a cool scene. And the whole thing is Melissa's picking out her fake name. right? We go straight from Simon saying, like, we're just waiting for Melissa to pick out a name. And then we cut to Melissa being like, I'm trying to think of a name. I think I have a good name. She tells Gina that she wants to use the name Joanna Barker. And I love this part because Gina kind of frowns. She kind of like makes a face and Melissa's watching her and she wonders to herself, she's like, that means that I must look like that when I'm like confused or frustrated because she's like a perfect body double and she studied me. I thought that was good. Melissa explains that Joanna Barker is a character from Sweeney Todd. She's like, don't you remember Sweeney Todd? And Gina's like, the demon barber of Fleet Street? I'm like, yeah, that one. Exactly. Gina's like, I don't know. But Melissa is determined. She loves it. She's so passionate. She really loves the idea of this character getting her like happily ever after, right? It's mostly that she has this whole headcanon. She explains all about like, no, I've always thought Joanna Barker, she went on to marry a tall, handsome man, lived happily ever after. It's funny. She has this whole justification. So this is why she picks Joanna Barker from Sweeney Todd. And the chapter ends with her just kind of like, she says that's the sort of omen she wants watching over her as she travels to meet. And it says, Melissa blushed at the thought, my betrothed, my Hans Davian, my future husband.
Swoon.
It is. She is. She is swooning. Yes, it does. The chapter ends with her swooning.
I would say it's a little dramatic, but it is coming from a 16-year-old. So, makes sense.
At least she's happy about the whole arranged marriage bit.
It's funny.
When I was reading this, I'm just thinking the whole time, like, Stackpole's gotta have something up with this whole naming convention. We've talked about so many times. He does not include a lot of extra useless information. And we go on for about half a chapter about this name.
Frivolousness is not really in his wheelhouse.
When I read this, I wondered if she'd seen that movie. This is in the future, so the movie would have already been out.
The interesting thing, though, is Stackpole would have not seen that movie.
No, he wouldn't have, but Melissa might have.
Right.
It's a much deeper pool in the 90s.
I just wanted to point out that I thought about this. When I read this part, I thought, I bet she saw that movie. And then I thought, it's too old, though. There's 1,000 years.
Yeah.
I wonder, do you think that any of our films survive? Do you think they're watching Goodfellas on holotape?
I bet there's some.
Man, I wonder what it is.
Yeah.
The Survivor.
It's probably not Pineapple Express.
Ghostbusters. Jurassic Park.
Oh, dude, Jurassic Park. That's my vote. Probably not.
Star Wars.
Star Wars. Yeah. I read Sweeney Todd and I did. I thought about like holotapes for a while, but that's it. So Andy is going to accompany Melissa back to the Federated Suns.
Under the guise of the name Joanna Barker, the demon barber of Fleet Street from the literary work Sweeney Todd.
That's correct. I've never read that.
Nor have I. Aaron?
I haven't read it either.
Maybe there's something here. Maybe there isn't. Who knows? We'll have to find out.
But that's it. That's the plan. That is the plan. It is a bit shaky. He's like, you're going to get on a drop ship and you're going to be like shuttled between jump ships. You're going on a little trip.
And by little, we're talking literally all the way across the inner sphere just about. It is a long journey.
Which is very risky when going through all this, especially when we have some unpulled plot lines that we learned very early on about commandeering jump ships. So
they'll be taking a commercial liner. It says that. They tell Andy that here. So they'll be riding together, but not on like a military thing. They're trying to blend in with the general population, right? I just wanted to point out, it says specifically that Andy will be traveling with Melissa back on a commercial spaceship.
That's very important. Yes. That makes sense, right? Trying to keep a low profile.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're sending out a rapid jump from one space to another with a military ship, it's probably going to raise more flags than just sending them out in your run of the mill.
Like fighting in a simulator.
Fighting in a simulator.
So, Aaron, you're our designated ignorant reader.
Thank you.
Of the podcast. So, what do you think? where's the boat sail from here?
Well, like I was saying earlier, we have the unconnected plot thread of a jump ship heist from earlier given to Gray. And to me, thinking about all of this, these are the plot lines that haven't had a chance to intersect much more than Andy being present during Justin's trial. So Stackpole's got to be working this as an angle to start tethering these things all together. Somehow we're going to have the meeting of all the factions we've established.
He did it.
Interesting. Look at you not thinking like a mech warrior, you know, not thinking all in strategy and tactics.
He's right. These last few chapters had to do some heavy lifting.
They didn't.
They did. Right? It was almost just a change of pace for Stackpole here.
Yeah.
We established some more business on Solaris 7 for Justin, and then we switch over here to Tharkad, and it's all plotting. It's all a scheme that's being built up upon. And we're establishing the characters that are going to take part in this scheme.
I'm going to be honest with you. That middle chapter, it felt a little bit like combat. It felt a little mech combat-y. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I agree. I think, yeah, we definitely have a duel.
There were some dice being rolled.
But it was a lot of establishing. And to me, that's what rings that bell, is that Stackpole doesn't do three chapters of establishing
right.
without having it be a critical point.
There is also some other people we haven't heard from. Something else that's been building in the right corner of the galaxy, you know, because galaxies have corners. But we'll have to see if your predictions prevail.
Well, we'll just have to see if Stackpole proves me right or wrong. Next week, we continue on Warrior on Guard.
This was another episode of Mechs and Men, a BattleTech book club. I am Kanan Hill. I was joined by my two friends, Brent and Aaron. We would like to thank the author of this book, Michael A. Stackpole. And we would like to thank, as always, all the other writers and artists who work so hard to keep BattleTech alive. We'd like to thank Catalyst Game Labs for being such generous stewards of the property. We have an email, advice@heat.management. Please, if you have any questions, concerns, corrections, advice@heat.management. We're on social media, Instagram, Twitter, @ofmechsandmen. Also, please feel free to leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Every little bit helps.
Most importantly, the listeners like you.
That's a great idea. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week to continue our discussion of Warrior on Guard by Michael A. Stackpole. Until then.
In lieu of my usual joke, I would like to make a mid-episode shout-out. There's two of you on the Discord, Code Travis and Dak and Back. You guys have been absolutely destroying us with these memes. We love it. Thank you. I'll be honest, had a couple hard days at work here this last week, and those memes, they helped me get through it. So thanks, Dak and Back, and Code Travis. You guys are some real ones.
Yes, they honor us, truly.
Till next time.
Selah.